Well, good morning. Thank you so much for being here today. I did want to make one announcement before we dive into it this morning. A few weeks ago, we had Bob and Donna Sloma from Alaska. Do you remember them from Alaska? They did a short presentation, and they talked about having teams go to Alaska, and I mentioned it'd be nice if we could have a team to go to Alaska. Well, they sent Pastor Gary, our missions pastor, a letter just the other day, and they had a team scheduled to come up at the end of July or the 1st of August, and that team has canceled. And they are looking for us to see if we can send a team, and they need at least four. Three will not work because there's just too much to do, and no more than 10. So we need between 4 and 10 people. And here is what you will be doing if you decide to go. They have homes that need some steel roofing put on. Being in a high forest fire danger area, one roof is cracked, so they need to fix that particular roof. They need to put a front deck on one home. It's unsafe. They need one home scraped and painted. They need landscaping, tree, brush removal, lawn mowing. They need 30 cords of firewood cut, split, and stacked. Yikesy. That's a lot. Wow. Okay. They also have a previous trailer and house site that needs to be cleaned up and other items as the summer unfolds. The total cost is approximately $1,200, of which is $800 round trip airfare from Boston. Around $1,000 for Manchester, and if you want to fly out of Bangor, it's $1,200. So the $1,200 includes pretty much everything except maybe a little bit of spending money and so forth. But anyway, that's kind of the overview. So if you're interested in going, you can see me after church. I'll be back in the Connection Center, or you can see Pastor Gary, our missions pastor, and say, yep, I'm interested, and we'll take your name down. And we'll see if we've got enough to pull it off. We've had some people say, I'm thinking about it, I'll let you know. So that's good. And if you can commit today and say, yep, I'm in, that'd be great. But if it's just one of those, take my name, I'll let you know. That's good too. And then I'll kind of work on it, or Gary work on it this week, and see if we can get 4 to 10 people. Have to have 4, can't have more than 10. So I kiddingly said we'd love to bring a team to Alaska. I didn't mean like in 2 months, 3 months. But anyway, we might be doing that anyway. So anyway, it should be really neat. How you doing today? Good? Great? I like that. Great. I like that. Tim, you've already been once today. What?
It was so good the first time.
You had to go through it again. All right. He was here at 8 o'clock and sang, and he's back for more. Awesome. Good. It's good to see you. How many watched the royal wedding? All right. Let me put it this way. How many would admit they watched the royal wedding? All right. Good. I wasn't planning on watching the royal wedding, but Saturday morning I got up as I normally do early and trying to just kind of catch the news, and the royal wedding was just getting started, and I watched, 5 minutes, and then I said, well, it's not too bad, and turned into 10 minutes, Marge, and then it was 30 minutes, and okay, I'm in. I just stayed in. And so I watched the whole thing. It was kind of interesting. It really was interesting how a young girl from America who came from a divided family and who could grow up and become a princess. So fairy tales do come true. It really happened. So I was telling the other crowds this morning, asked my wife, would you want to marry one of the most richest bachelors and a prince or me? Probably shouldn't have asked that question. And like every good wife, she lied and said, you, of course, honey, of course. So anyway, it was kind of funny to watch in some ways. In other ways, it was kind of neat to watch. But, the Buckingham Palace, I mentioned a few weeks ago in one of our lessons here in Solomon, that that's the richest residence in the world, $1.5 billion. Imagine that, marrying somebody and having access to the richest home in the world. Wow. Well, anyway, I don't know, for those of you that didn't watch it, it's amazing to me how one couple, when you stop and think about it, can really, in some ways, whether it's negatively or positive, you can decide, but bring the whole world to watch. Really fascinating, isn't it? So if you think you had a big wedding, this was a big wedding. This was a real big wedding. Well, today we are going to once again embark on this particular book of Ecclesiastes. Remember the context. Solomon is an old man. Terry, you identify with that, right? Being an old man yourself. And he looked down the corridors of life and he saw a lot of things. And he saw a lot of things that can really help us in this life. And there were a lot of regrets that Solomon had. He was the wisest man possibly that ever lived. We can argue that. He was, without question, one of the richest men that ever lived. We know that. Definitely in his time, for sure. He had people from all over the world, people like the Queen of Sheba and others that came and asked him questions that they wanted answers to because of his great wisdom that God had given him. But you know, in all of that, even he had some regrets. Isn't that amazing? And so what he does, he writes this book so you and I can learn from it and hopefully draw closer to God in the process. And maybe not, when we get to the end of our age, have as many regrets as he had. So with that being said, chapter 4 gives us 6 frustrations of the heart. Last week, of course, our lesson was abbreviated because Deb shared with the ladies. She did a great job, and we gave out some gifts to the ladies. So we kind of introduced this chapter last week, so we're going to finish it this week. But the first 3 verses talked about the first great frustration that Solomon saw and dealt with, and that was that of oppression, that people who are working are oppressed. And the context of chapter 4 has to do with work. Then second of all, we see the problem of envy and rivalry. That's in verse 4. Verse 5 is the problem of slothfulness or being lazy. That's verse 5. 6 deals with the problem of covetousness. Verses 7 through 12 deals with the problem of loneliness. And then verses 13 through 16 deals with the problem of elusive fame and power. You ready to dive in? Now, are you sure? Okay, here we go. Let's dive in. Let's look at, first of all, verse number 4. We're going to put that on the screen. Number 2, the problem of envy and rivalry. Here's what he said. Then I observed that most people are motivated to success. He's talking about people that are working, people that are going somewhere, because they envy their neighbors. Not because they enjoy their job, not because they just want to be successful, but because they have actually a demented or sinful motive. Think about that. To basically impress their neighbors where they can have more than them. But he said, this too is meaningless. It's like chasing after the wind. Solomon saw that the desire of people that were working sometimes in this idea of succeeding, however we might define that, was driven by jealousy, sometimes even cruel intentions, keeping up with our neighbors, sadly, to have bigger and better. We fall into that too, don't we, sometimes? Well, they have it, so I need it. We don't really need it, but we want to outdo them. To be admired by others. Oh my goodness, if people could just see my car, or in Maine, my car, right? They could just see my car. Boy, if they could just see my house. Boy, if they could just see my clothes, how I dress. If they would just admire me. Sometimes, sadly, we even slander and injure those who have more than us. Solomon saw that with people working. He saw that some were oppressed. Then he comes over here and he goes, yeah, but there's another group of people that work, and they're in for it just for people to see what they have so they can have more than others. In Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 30, Proverbs is a great book. It gives us many, many jewels. A peaceful heart leads to a healthy body. Oh boy. Jealousy, envy is like what, church? Cancer. Yeah, cancer in the bones. The NASB puts it this way: a sound heart is the life of the flesh, a healthy body. But envy, the rottenness of the bones. The rottenness of the bones. In Galatians chapter 5 and verse 21, the Apostle Paul here gives us a litany of areas of the flesh. And we're just picking up with what he's continuing here. Envy, drunkenness, wild parties, and other sins like these. Let me tell you again, as I have said before, that anyone living that sort of life will not inherit the kingdom of God. Now you say, Jerry, but I struggle occasionally with envy, and you know, gee, I've been drunk before, and I've gone to some wild parties. What Paul is saying is that this is not typical of your everyday lifestyle. In other words, thank God you've been saved out of this lifestyle. This is not you. Not that you might not struggle in some of those even now on occasion, but thank God that your heart has been transformed. And what he is saying is, heaven will not be a place where this takes place. But notice what he lists: envy. And here, this second frustration after oppression, Solomon saw envy and rivalry. I just wanted to share two or three quick examples of envy and rivalry. The first one is found in Genesis chapter 37, verse 4, and we'll look at that. But his brothers hated Joseph. They were envious of Joseph because their father, who was the father of Joseph? Anybody know? Okay. It's not a trick question out there at all. You know, it's not a trick question. Okay. So Joseph, because their father loved him more than the rest of them. Now this is sad. This is really sad. They couldn't even say one kind word. That's really sad, isn't it? That they hated him so much. There was so much rivalry going on that they couldn't even say one thing positive about him. Many of you, not all of you, but many of you know the story. They took him. They roughed him up, right? Threw him in an empty well or a hole. And they left him there for a while, and then they were going to kill him. And then one of the brothers stepped in and said, well, we better not kill him. That's not a good thing to do. Let's take his coat that his father had given to him, Jacob had given to him. They dipped it in what? Yeah, some blood. And they sold Joseph into slavery. He headed down to Egypt. They went home and said, oh, Dad, you'll never believe what happened. A wild animal killed your favorite son. And by the way, here is his coat. And down deep, they're laughing about it, I'm sure. You know, the sad part of this story, there are a lot of sad parts. One is the attitude of the brothers, but even worse than that is a father who has a broken heart due to deception. And everyone here that's been a parent can put yourself in that place to a certain degree. And here for years, Jacob's heart was broken for something that wasn't even true. Boy, you talk about envy and rivalry and bitterness. That's how bad they hated their own brother. There's another example in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 8. Let's look at that one really quick. This made Saul, the king of Israel, very angry. What's this? He said, they credit David with 10,000s and me with only thousands. Next, they'll be making him their king. Well, that's exactly what happened. And David slays Goliath, and then he becomes a military officer under the leadership of Saul, and he becomes very famous, and Saul gets jealous. He becomes envious. A rivalry breaks out, not with David, but with Saul. And it comes to the place that it's so bad that King Saul decides to kill David. And David, by the way, as some of you might know, has some opportunities to kill the king, but he doesn't do it because he says, God says that we should not kill the king. There's another example, the prodigal son. In Luke 15, 28, we'll look at that together as well. The older brother was angry and would not go in. His father came out and begged him to come in. Once again, the story is a very simple story. In Luke chapter 15, we have the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And Jesus here is giving us a trilogy of stories or parables to talk about his love for those that are lost. And we find here in this third story that the prodigal son talks his father into giving him his inheritance. And that wasn't supposed to be gotten until the father died, but his father gave it anyway, and the son went off, and what did he do? He spent it all. By the way, the word prodigal means not what you might think it means. It means to be spendful. To spend everything is what it means. Lavish. And so he spends everything. Finds himself homeless with nothing. Finally comes to his senses after his friends leave him. Isn't that funny? When the money left, the friends left. He finds himself in a situation that he says, well, maybe my father might hire me as one of his servants. Gets his knapsack, begins to walk home, and there he sees his father coming toward him, waiting for his son to return. Kind of reminds you of Jesus waiting for us, doesn't it? And there the father goes and puts his arm around his son. He kisses him and gives him part of his raiment and ring and sandals and all the things that he needs. Kind of helps him get back together. Decides to throw a party and says, hey, go get the finest steaks. And yet his brother complains, is envious, and tells his father, you've never treated me that way. And his father says, look, you've got everything I have, and you always have, and you always will. He said, your brother was lost, but now he is. Yeah. He was blind, and now he can see. Terrible to have that kind of envy and rivalry in families. And we see here that as Solomon looks at certain people that were working, they were working out of envy, out of rivalry. What a sad place to be. In verse number 5, we see another verse. The next point, the problem of slothfulness. Fools fold their idle hands, leading them to ruin. Another version says they fold their hands, and very interesting, it says they consume their own flesh. That's interesting, isn't it? Simply means they bring themselves to ruin. And the idle hands or the folding of the hands has reference to it's very difficult to work when your hands are folded, aren't they? And of course, the context in Solomon's day would be dealing with agriculture, wouldn't it, or animals. So you couldn't work if your hands were together or they were idle. And so Solomon sees one group that were oppressed of workers. He sees another group that worked out of envy and rivalry just to outdo somebody else. And then he sees another group of workers who wouldn't work at all. They were lazy. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10, Paul writes to the church at Thessalonica, and he says, even while we were with you, we gave you this command, those unwilling to work will not get to what, church? Eat. There's a principle that God has given us that we were created to work. And idle hands is not good at all. What's he talking about? He's talking about people who purposefully, knowingly decide not to work. I said it last week or the week before in this series, it ought never be said about a believer in Jesus Christ at their work that they are lazy. Never. In fact, that ought to be just the opposite. Could you just slow down a little bit? Take a break. Or as we like to say, take a chill pill. I mean, just relax. In other words, we ought to work what we're paid to work. Amen, church? Very, very important. Notice the different kinds of people Solomon saw as he looks back the quarter of his life, now as an older gentleman, and what he sees. Then he sees the problem of covetousness. The problem of covetousness. In verse number 6, we see it. And yet, better to have one handful with quietness than two handfuls with hard work and chasing after the wind. First, he dealt with people who were oppressed. Then he dealt with people who were obsessed. Then he dealt with people that were lazy. And now he deals with people who are working to gain things, not to keep up or to show, but because they love the things of this world. Those who strike a balance, just about every survey or research study that you'll read, those that have a balanced life have a life where they have more peace, more tranquility, they are happier, they are less stressed, and they can actually sleep at night without medicine. Balanced life. I did a little research on balanced life. Came up with an article about an individual who gives us 7 quick things on how to have a balanced life. And I won't go into detail, but 1 is physical health. You need to take care of yourself. 2, family. You need to have a balanced family life. Ask questions like, how balanced do you feel with your family time? What's your relationship like with your spouse? How are things going with your kids? How are things going with your extended family members? Here's a good one. How are you doing with your mother-in-law? Right? Or your sister-in-law? Then socially is 3. Do you have a routine network of friends? Good question. Do you have a group of folks that you hang out with and do life with? The great thing about the article, I didn't write it, but boy, it sure fits into a lot of biblical things here, even in discipleship. Then 4, finances. Are your finances in order? Are you spending more than you bring in? Look, I don't have any degrees in finances. But here's what I know. If you spend more than you make, it's not good. How's that? Pretty good, isn't it? You don't have to be very bright. You don't have to have a PhD in finances or statistics to know that. Here's another one, business or job. Are you excited that you're making a difference wherever you are? In culture, it's important. Here's another one, civic. Do you give time? Do you invest at all in the things that you care about in the community? Another good question. And then lastly, spiritual. Now, this is not a Christian writer, so here's what he says about spiritual. This is the non-Christian perspective of spiritual. The final aspect of living a balanced life is your spiritual life. He says, this could be anything from taking a walk in the woods. That could be a spiritual experience. To making a trip to church on Sunday. Whatever fills up your spiritual cup. I would say to us at Crosspoint, Jesus is what fills up your spiritual cup. Jesus does that. Solomon looked out and he saw a group of people who weren't balanced. They were struggling, which affected all parts of their life. They weren't balanced. They were greedy. They were coveting things. If we're not careful, the strive for the things of this world, if we're not careful, we can lose our family. We can lose our kids. We can lose our health. We can lose our good name. How many names have we heard and seen in the news in the last couple of years of people that were greedy? We can lose our reputation. And if we're not careful, we can even lose a peace of mind. And something else, we can miss the pleasure of life that God has given us. 1 Timothy chapter 6, let's look at these verses beginning in verse 6. True godliness with contentment in itself is great gain or great wealth. After all, we brought nothing with us when we came into the world, and we can't take anything with us when we leave it. So if we have enough food and clothing, let's be content and praise God for what He's given us. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't have more clothes than we need, or it looks around, starting with me, we have more food than we need, for sure, right? What he's saying is be content with what God has given you. Don't always be in the trap of wanting more and more and trying to keep up with this person or that person, as we talked about in the first oppression. Covetousness, having a balance, that's the key. I want to look at the next one, the problem of loneliness. If I were to guess today at church, we've got some lonely people. Lonely people. He next looks at a group of people, and some believe that in this example, he's actually looking at a particular person who's a workaholic. Let's look at the verses. Ready? I observe, Solomon said, yet another example of something that's meaningless under the sun. This is the case of a person or a man, it could be a woman just as well today, more likely a man in his culture, but not so much in our culture, a man who was all alone. No children, no brothers, no family. He's disconnected himself from family. Yet who works hard to gain as much wealth as he can. Nothing wrong with working hard, nothing wrong with gaining wealth. But he asked himself this question, who am I working for? That's the question. That's a good question. Why am I giving up so much pleasure now? It's all so meaningless and depressing. Two people are better off than one, for they can help each other succeed. If one person falls, the other can reach out and help, but someone who falls alone is in real trouble. Likewise, two people lying close together can keep each other warm, but how can one be warm alone? A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer, defend themselves. But three are even better, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. What's he talking about? He looks out and he sees a man working his whole life. He's all alone. He's a workaholic. He's all by himself. You see, what Solomon is saying is two people can work together and even make more money and produce more. He's saying that they could provide warmth together. You see the context, thousands of years ago, two men would travel together. In the evening, they would stop. You know, there were no Ramada Inns, and they could not stay in a Holiday Inn Express either, right? And so what they would do is they would get off, you know, their horse or get off their donkey or their camel or whatever they might be riding on, or maybe they were just walking. They might have a little tent, possibly. Most likely, they just ride out on the ground underneath the stars, on the cold ground. And sometimes the two guys would get close to each other because there's body heat. You know, a few years ago, I went to China to teach. And we landed and got in the vehicle and drove 3 hours north. And it was wintertime, and it was bitter cold. It was really cold. And we were taken into this ghost city. Those are cities that China has built, and they're going to fill them with people. There were no people there yet. It was really eerie. reminds you of one of those movies where, you know, everybody had left because of disease, or, you know, the zombies were there or something, you know, or, but it was really kind of weird. But we were taken into this complex, this compound rather, and they shut the door. We never saw the outside for a week. There was no heat. It was cold. It was time to go to bed, and Dr. Nanakin and I were together, and Dr. Nanakin, by the way, just got the Faculty of the Year Award at the Liberty School of Divinity. So he just got a great award. He used to be our missions pastor, and we still support him as one of our missionaries. He now teaches theology at Liberty University School of Divinity. Back to my story. So it was really cold, and we went to bed that night, and we were in a very small room. Our beds were very close together, and we wore all our clothes, shoes, everything, double socks, put on all the clothes we had, and we had a blanket over us. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and we started laughing, and we started mentioning these verses. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and of course, all you could see was, you know, the white of our eyes. And we made a decision together that it wasn't quite cold enough. Wasn't quite cold enough. That's the first time I almost slept, my first time with a man from India. That almost happened, all right? That almost happened. I mean, it was really, really close to happening. But we were able to pull it off for the week. And a little bit later on, they got a little heat, but I mean, it was cold. So I'll never forget that night the rest of my life. And we laugh about that to this day. So he's going to be preaching here this summer. So maybe I'll have him reference that time that we almost slept together in China. That's how cold it was. Well, in the context of Solomon, that's what would happen. Two guys would lie together against one another, stay warm if it's real cold. And then he goes on to say that two men can defend themselves better than one. That makes sense, right? If you're in a fight, better to have a friend, right, than all by yourself. But you know something else about this I thought of, that not only do people need companionship, relationship, because that's really what he's getting at here, but you know, even spiritually, we need relationship, companionship. It doesn't matter how rich you are here today. It doesn't matter how much education you have here today. Some of you may not agree with this. You agree with it, but you'll never admit it. But you cannot be effective doing life by yourself. God created us as relational beings. And one of the reasons that we believe in the Trinity is because we were created in the very image of God, three persons, one God. God has not just one being, but three persons. God has always been in relationship. And he created us to be in relationship. I mean, if God was not a Trinity, how would God love? See, the Father loves the Son, and the Son loves the Holy Spirit, and vice versa. And God's created us in the same way. Yet not three persons, one person, yet one being. Aren't you glad you don't have three beings? That'd be a real problem. It's hard enough getting along with your being, right, than two more of you. But look at this verse in Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves always, or at all times. A friend is loyal, and a brother is born to help in a time of need. He's talking about community. He's talking about not being a workaholic. This person didn't even take time to get married. Didn't take time to have a family. I'm not saying you have to do those things, but his point was, this man lived all by himself, and he worked all the time, not enjoying the things of this world, the pleasure of this world. And he regretted it. Now, you may not regret it if that's you, but there are those that do regret it. I found some interesting things in regards to workaholic. Now, all the wives know that the husbands are a workaholic or vice versa, you know. So I just want to give you some things that you can kind of bite into in regards to whether or not you're a workaholic or not. Thought you might find this interesting, might start some fights, I don't really know, but you know, wait at least till you leave, that'd be good. There was a study done from the country of Norway, from the University of Bergen. And Norway is kind of close to me. I lived there 9 years. I used to be fluent Norwegian, and I can still speak some of it, like Vagamaladu, Vahedu, Viburu, that kind of thing. I just asked you how old you were, where do you live, and what's your name? You just thought I was kind of half nuts, but that's actually a language, right? So anyway, here's a study done by the University of Bergen in Norway. 7 signs to determine whether or not you, man or female, are a workaholic. Ready? Number one, you think of ways when you're not working to free up time so you can work. Now, I just want you to know that these 7 things do not relate at all to your pastor. I just want you to know that, okay? This is for everybody else in the room. Number two, you work more than initially you intended to. Let me give you some examples. Honey, I just need to stop by the office for 30 minutes. That's all I need. And 4 hours later, you get home. And that happens regularly. Or, Terry, can you grab me that right there in that basket? You'll see it. You know what it is. It's my iPhone. Thank you, Terry. Honey, I just need to check my messages because, you know, I am so important that somebody at work needs me 24/7. Jane, somebody's going to die. I've got to check my phone. You know, I know somebody's in the hospital. All right, right? Number three, you work to reduce feelings of guilt, anxiety, helplessness, or depression. In other words, that's how you medicate yourself. It's not through a bottle or needle or the refrigerator. It's through work. You're addicted to work. You know, every time I've done this all morning, I can hear a pin drop every time I do these 7 things. Number four, others continually tell you you're working too much and to cut back, and you don't listen. Number five, when you get stressed, it's primarily when you are prohibited from working. In other words, you have work withdrawals. You get antsy. You get edgy, you get moody, and so that's why sometimes your spouse says, oh, just go to work then, right? Because you're only working anyway, but you're not there. And so like an alcoholic or an addict, for you, it's work withdrawals. You get really edgy. I got to get that report done. I've got to check that phone message. I've got to send that email. Number six, you deprioritize things like hobbies, things like leisure activities, exercise. I joined that gym. I know I need to work out 30 minutes a day, but you know what? I know we haven't been on vacation in 95 years. I know that, but next year, honey. I know. Right? I know we need to go over and see them. I know we need to ask them out for dinner. I know. But, you know, this report and, you know, next month it's this and next month it's this. And years go what? Click, click, click. And before you know it, you're too old to want to go anywhere, right? And number seven, according to our Norwegian friends, it gets to the point that you are literally affected due to poor health from addiction. You break down physically, emotionally, psychologically, and yes, even spiritually. I know I should have a devotion every morning, but you know, that 5 or 10 minutes, I can get that report done and I can get a little bit further ahead for the day. I would challenge you to do your devotion first, and God may allow you to get more done that day. Just try it. Try it. The study says that in Norway, about 8.3% are bona fide workaholics, and in the rest of the Western world, it's about 10%. So I don't know, we got 300 or 400 people here today. So that means we've got 30 to 40 bona fide addicts that are workaholics. That's what Solomon saw. And lastly, moving on before I get fired, verses 13 through 16. Let's look at those verses. It is better to be poor, but a wise youth. It's better to be a poor guy who's young than old and a foolish king who refuses all advice. Such a young kid or youth or young man could rise from poverty. And once again, we don't know if this is hypothetical or maybe he's referring to a specific instance, maybe even himself, because he could be referring to Jeroboam, who was poor and the son of a widow who ended up becoming a king and taking his place because his son blew it. Such a youth could rise from poverty and succeed. He might even become king, though he has been in prison. But then everyone rushes to the side of yet another youth who replaces him. And here he talks about the cyclical part of life. There's nothing new under the sun, right? Endless crowds stand around him, but then another generation grows up and rejects him too. So it is all meaningless, like chasing the wind. Solomon concludes once again, our work without God has no value. It's absolutely meaningless. Who does he describe? Different kinds of workers that he sees. So let's close with one verse. In Galatians chapter 1, we find our value. Now, I think this is much more difficult, as we said, I think a couple of weeks ago, with men, because we have a tendency more than women, and I think that might be changing some, but I think for the most part, men are known or identified by what they do. And I think women now also as well, but maybe not to the level of degree. But obviously, Paul said, as he wrote to the church that was scattered throughout Galatia, which encompasses a lot of different places. Galatia is a region, not a city. Obviously, I'm not trying to win the approval of people. Paul was defending his apostleship. He was having a hard time because people were making fun of him. They weren't believing him. They didn't. And so now he writes, this is, hey, I'm not trying to win the approval of you, but of God. If pleasing people were my goal, I would not be Christ's servant. So the question that we need to answer as we leave today is this. Are we living our lives as workers and people at large to please other people? Or are we living our lives as workers and people at large to please Jesus? That's the question. That's a good question. And there's only one person in this room that can answer it, and that's you. You're the only one that can answer that question. I want to show you our prayer here at Cross Point. If you guys could put our prayer up. You know, the scary part about this here is that you can live your life and you can make gobs of money. I mean gobs of money. And yet, if you're not careful, you can miss the pleasures of life, but more importantly than the pleasures of life, you can miss the pleasures of eternal life. You can have it all here, but when you die, it's all going to stay here. And I would challenge you today, if you're not absolutely sure that when you die that you're going to heaven, that you settle that today. And we do that by recognizing that we are a sinner, that we are imperfect, that we are filled with a disease called sin. And there's nothing that we can do. Nothing. And to believe that God sent His Son, Jesus, to pay our price that we could not pay. Aren't you glad, church, that there was somebody who paid a debt that you could not pay? I know I'm thankful. And Jesus paid that on the cross. And through His shed blood, and through His pain, and through His agony, and through His death, burial, and resurrection, He paid our price. And we can pray today this short prayer and invite Him into our life if we're sincere. But for the rest of us that know Jesus already, second part of the verse is to help us grow spiritually as your disciple. And part of that growth is understanding and recognizes that we don't grow for others per se. We do, but we don't. We grow that others might see Jesus in us and that we actually become Jesus in the flesh here. So we can be that example that people will see, that they'll be drawn to the Father through us, and we introduce them to the Son. You see, you can't be a disciple if you're living your life for you. That's impossible. And until we eradicate that part of ourselves as Christians and make a decision that we want to live our life to please God rather than men. Now, in that process, however, we will please men. But we have it reversed. We please men by our life. In other words, they're blessed by our life because we bring spirituality into them where they need it. So I want you to stand this morning, if you would, just for a few minutes. As Jason plays for us. I don't know where you are today in your spiritual life, but as we take just a couple of minutes to pray before Pastor Pencil closes our service, if you're not sure heaven's your home, then you need the first part. If you know heaven's your home, then you need the second part. Obviously, if you don't know Jesus, you need both, but let's start at the top, work our way down. And I guess the best way to close our service is just for us to ponder the question, am I living my life to please men, or am I living my life to please God? That's the bottom line. So I want you to bow your head and close your eyes. And as Jason plays for about a minute, you to spend some time with God. The good news is, you say, oh, Pastor, I have failed miserably. Hey, the good news is another test can start tomorrow because you can take up that F that you have and tear it up and throw it away. And you can start brand new tomorrow. Amen, church? So let's spend some time and then we'll close our service and pray.